So a very warm welcome to tonight's Modern French History Seminar. I'm really pleased to introduce tonight's speaker, who is Constance Bantman, who is lecturer in French at the University of Surrey. She's published a range of pieces, lots and lots on anarchist history, including her book, in 2013, The French Anarchists in London, Exile and Transnationalism, also Scales of Analysis in Anarchist Studies will be coming out soon, or is it out? It's coming out soon. And New Perspectives on Anarchism, Labour and Syndicalism. But this comes from a new project that she's working on, which is writing a transnational history, but using transnational approaches to focus on biography and thinking about the place of individuals in these transnational histories. So it's a focus on individual anarchists and how we engage with the transnational turn. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me today. It's a pleasure to be here. So as Alison kindly explained, I've been working for about 10 years on anarchist transnationalism, digging up and writing up the history of about 500 French anarchists who came into exile in London in the 1890s in a context of heavy police repression in France, as the anarchist movement underwent a terrorist phase, which claimed the lives of quite a few heads of state across the Western world and in France, among other countries. So this is my book. Sorry if I can start like this. This is the monograph I wrote about this French group in London. And what I've been focusing on is really trying to map out the personal connections between these exiles and the British host during their stay here, as well as Italian anarchists who were also present in London at the time, and to a lesser extent, really it's in the background, the United States and Latin America. So trying to sketch out a map of intense anarchist transnational activism, and I've been focusing specifically on the roles of personal networks in that informal activism and individual key actors. So in the jargon, we tend to call them mediators, intermediaries, go-betweens, or the French term passeur, to describe these individuals who are absolutely pivotal to setting up networks of militancy. So my current research, which is really an emerging project, is about one of these actors, and he was not a London exile. He was, in fact, remarkably sedentary by the standards of the period. This is Jean Grave. I like to call him the immobile transnationalist because he spent most of his militant career in his attic in the Latin Quarter on the Rue Mouffetard, and typically this is Jean Grave surrounded by books, really in very much characteristic representation. Eventually, what I'd like to do is draw comparisons between different types of international, transnational intermediaries, and especially Louise Michel, because Louise Michel is an interesting figure, a very significant record of transnational activism, which has largely gone unrecorded, although Martin, who is present here, is writing the history of Louise Michel's anarchist school on Fitzroy Square, not so far from here. But other than this, there is not so much recording of a very rich transnational activism. And compared to Grave, Louise Michel had a very wide repertoire of activism, ranging from journalism, literature, writing, holding the stage during conferences, during marches, demonstrations, opening a school. So a wide range of militant actions. By contrast, Grave was a man of the written word, and this is how he carried out his militancy, through an absolutely staggering written output, including especially journalism. There are also many other points which are interesting about Grave. Of course, this is what you need, I guess, for a good biography. A very intriguing personality, described as a very cantankerous man, but in practice, in his writings, he comes across as a very kind and caring person as well, almost lyrical personality at times. Also, this tension, which I will really talk about today, between on the one hand his incredible transnational network, and I would venture that Grave commanded what was possibly one of the largest anarchist networks at the time, and possibly one of the largest informal political networks in the period, full stop. But at the same time, this extreme sedentary character, which was very unusual for the anarchist movement, which was global and extremely mobile in this period. So that tension is interesting. And of course, his personal life, which is quite fascinating. Also, I'm especially interested in the moment in his second marriage to Welsh artist Mabel Holland, who was the sister-in-law of one Sir Isambard Owen, who was the vice-chancellor of Bristol University at a time when Graf stayed in exile in their house in Bristol during the First World War. And Owen, so Graf's brother-in-law, happened to be the executor of the will of Prince Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte. So an interesting connection here for an eminent anarchist. So a man of paradoxes and mystery. What I am interested in through this history is really examining how the concepts of networks and transnational activism, as opposed to a strictly institutional and national outlook, can shed a completely new light on supposedly well-known individuals and movements. So it brings in a revisionist perspective, which is often the main argument for adopting a transnational perspective. So this is part of a broader interest in the mechanisms and experience of transnational activism in the late 19th century. So Graf's periodicals at their peak were read and disseminated anarchist ideas pretty much across the globe. They had a circulation at their peak between 8,000 and 18,000 copies per issue, and they were published on a weekly or bi-monthly basis over a period, as you can see here, of, with editorial changes over 35 years. So really, really prolific output. And Graf's career, it did not stop in 1922 when he has to relinquish the editorship of his beloved latest venture, Le Temps Nouveau. It doesn't quite stop there, but it's pretty much the beginning of the end and the end of an era. But Graf's career, his own career, really reflects the good and bad fortunes of the anarchist movement itself. So if we start in 1879, we have the emergence of the anarchist movement on the coattails, so to speak, of the First International. And then in the 1880s, the transnational growth of this movement with the emergence of significant anarchist groupings in different countries across, here for the purpose of the talk, really, I will focus on Europe in this case. In the 1880s and 1890s, anarchism underwent a terrorist phase, as I mentioned initially, and again, Graf was very much involved in the discussion of these developments. After 1890s, the movement partly evolves towards syndicalism again. This is a very simplistic account, and Graf, again, is involved in these discussions. The beginning of the 20th century is focused on a variety of new developments and increasingly on anti-militarism and the fight against the impending war, which, again, is one aspect which has been poorly documented. And I think this is a very striking illustration of how this transnational outlook can highlight some important militant themes which have been ignored otherwise, and in this case, the anti-militarist record of the anarchists, and then the war, which signals the end of this heroic period of anarchism as it's been known. So another strong argument for studying the movement through Graf is really that he reflects the history of the movement as a whole in France. So in this talk, what I would like to do is to present Graf's networks, but also to discuss how they might be presented. What is the best way to write a history of anarchism using this idea of networks, and also what is the ideological assumption, what is the broader narrative? It's very nice to use the concept of network. Of course, it's quite trendy, but what is the broader meaning of it, and what sense do we get out of it? One aspect before I finish introduction, which I would like to highlight, is that I am far from being alone in being interested in this anarchist transnationalism. And one thing I'm hoping to do is also to draw attention to all this very interesting theoretical work being produced by historians of anarchism, because I think we tend to work in isolation. And I think in the context of the ongoing global stroke transnational turn, I think there is a lot to be learned in methodological terms from the anarchist movement, because it had this amazing organization, informal organization, which is quite unique, especially at the time. So to give an idea of this very dynamic field of research, here's a list of publications, all of which are posterior to 2013. So my colleague Davide Torcato, his excellent biography of Malatesta, which is really used as a case study for a transnational reading of anarchist history. Pietro Di Paola, who's a senior lecturer at Lincoln, wrote a very similar biography to mine, studying the Italian anarchists in London. This is, sorry, another publication of mine, which is really, it's a case study, but this time it's a collection of articles, so reassessing the transnational turn scales of analysis in anarchist and syndicalist studies, but we have case studies for many, many different areas, not only Europe. There is something on Havana, for instance, on Latin American developments. A very new book, which I haven't read yet, so Cooperation and Japanese-Russian Intellectual Relations in Modern Japan, so Japanese-Russian Anarchist Networks. This is, sorry, very, very poor image, but this is about Puerto Rico as an anarchist hub, as it's called, as a place of exchange in those transnational networks. And this is a slightly unusual book because it's a very different understanding of networks. You can see transatlantic anarchist networks. It's a very crude interpretation of networks as being terrorist networks, a very basic understanding. It's a book which hasn't been received terribly well by anarchist historians, very well received in American academia. So an interesting take on this idea of anarchist networks. So before proceeding, of course, I'd like to talk a bit more about what I mean by this term of networks. So first of all, when I speak of transnational history, I think for many of my colleagues studying anarchism, we tend to assume that we speak about informal connections. That is to say, not established groups, but we talk about connections between individuals, sometimes with groups, informal links. And I think that's not a given for historians of transnationalism in general. I think this was one of the points highlighted by the conference at Brunel last year. So in this case, transnationalism tends to refer primarily to informal links. The reasons why anarchists tended to opt for informal modes of organization, although not exclusively, of course, was there were several reasons. Well, first of all, a very strong ideological argument for less hierarchical, anti-hierarchical forms of organization. Of course, this is one of the key principles of the political philosophy of anarchism, the opposition to hierarchies and formal organization. There was, I think, as well, a double pragmatic argument. First, we are talking about a period of intense political repression, and transient organizations were certainly more congenial in that context. And we're also talking about a movement where there could be quite a lot of heated ideological differences as well. And I think there is something there also which was more conducive to having a network-based organization. So, of course, the good fortunes of the this use of networks in history, they have many different origins, and it's quite, again, a trendy way of looking at social interactions and modes of ideological diffusion. And a variety of influences, I think, which are variously cited in these different books and across the field. So typically, Eric Hobsbawm and E.P. Thompson's Social Histories from Below. Some historians refer to Bruno Latour's Actor Network Theory as well. Mark Hanovetter's Diffusion Models through the Strengths of Weak Ties. And in a French context, which I really feel closer to, Le Métron, Le Dictionnaire Biographique du Mouvement Ouvrier, which is this multi-volume biographic endeavor to write the history of the labor movement by tracing the biographies of a variety of actors more or less well known. And last year, a tome dedicated specifically to the anarchists was published. So I think here with the cover of the Métron, we really see this emphasis on the individual and the role of the individual in constructing political movement. I use the term network in a loose, non-technical, non-quantitative sense to describe associations of varying size, intensity over time, density, geographical reach. The networks I describe are hybrid in ideological terms. So, for instance, if we look at the time of the Dreyfus affair, the anarchists in France were very prominent in the defense of Capitaine Dreyfus, well, after some time, but they were also part of a broader coalition, a broader progressive coalition, and they joined demonstrations on this occasion. They took part in joint campaigns, fundraising events, and they came into associations with other parties, Socialist Party typically, emerging Socialist Party, or individuals, for instance, who were advocates of parliamentary democracy. So this is what I mean by hybrid networks. They could connect with other movements. This is, I think, one of the advantages of adopting the network point of view, because you do get this idea of interlocking with other networks. They're also hybrid in terms in their composition. So a typical anarchist network, we'll talk about Graves in a bit, could be composed of several individuals, of local circles, say based in the 20th arrondissement. They could comprise, for instance, a journal, a newspaper, and its editorial team. So here you have quite a mixed little network with different components. And this is, again, why I use this term. It's been described as a metaphorical use of the term of network. And this use, of course, tends to be frowned upon by historians who do formal network analysis. But I still find it's very useful to pick and choose some of these technical terms to describe a reality which is quite complex in organizational terms. Other terms which have been used over the years to describe anarchist organizations have been, for instance, circles. People talk of anarchist circles, but I find this extremely vague, and especially if we're looking at local movements based in an arrondissement, this is fine. On a national level, this is less effective, but on a transnational scale, it really doesn't work to talk about circles. Groups, the term of group was dismissed by the anarchists themselves at the time. Some later historians have spoken of loose affinity groups, but I think this is a little too loose in that case and a little unspecific. So I'm aware of the flaws of the term of network, but I still find it's... It has some advantages. Now, this is an example of a formal network analysis of anarchist networks. So I use the term a Hoyt network. It's not very kind because it refers to my colleague Andrew Hoyt, who is based in the United States, where he's currently doing his doctorate. And he is clearly doing some structural network analysis around anarchist networks in the United States, which were really considerable in size. So, as you can imagine, everything is coded, the shapes, the size of the arrows, and his contention is very interesting. His idea, and this is very often the assumption of a network analyst, is that if you adopt this kind of approach, you can highlight links which purely narrative accounts do not evidence. So, in the case of anarchism, he claims that some of these groups are always... described as being completely antagonistic in ideological terms, and that this leads to obscuring the very significant links that existed between them. So this is very interesting, and I guess it's a strong argument for a more quantitative approach, but nothing precludes the use of a little quantitative approach to highlight these links. But I still find, of course, this comes at the end of an article, but I still find there's a great deal that is lost, and especially with the flavour, I suppose, of these exchanges, it's great to know that all these groups and people were in touch, but it's even nicer to know what they were saying to each other and also in what terms specifically. So still in favour of a more narrative, discursive approach to these networks. Moving on from the figure of the... from the network, we arrive at this concept of intermediary, the mediator, who is at the heart very often of the networks, and certainly in Graf's case. So there is a lot less literature, and I find this is actually a bit of a blind spot. Not much has been written about these actors who were pivotal in the context of a transnational, international movement, and yet they were very, very influential. So I wrote something about Émile Pouget, a few years back. So here is, Émile Pouget was a London exile, actually, where he printed his famous paper, Le Père Pénard, one of the better known anarchists of the time. And this is the card that the police kept of him. This is how they traced him when he was in London, the record they kept of him. And Pouget was a man who went from being typically very French, very... French-focused, militant, to becoming a very active internationalist after his stay in London. He published his paper in London and became a representative in some international labour organisation. And here is you see an ad for his Père Pénard, and you see at the footnote, La Révolte, so one of Clav's papers, L'Insurgé. And you can see that even in a small ad for a paper, he was building networks, advertising other papers, making links, building bridges. And this is a very strong feature kind of the anarchist movement. So Pouget, an interesting case. And what I was especially interested in is how one becomes a transnationalist. And especially at the time, pre-World War One, it's a period where the Western labor movements are in a bit of a double bind. On the one hand, an increasing nationalization of the working classes, increasing national integration, very strong nationalist pull. But on the other hand, a time of great international mobility and a period of great internationalist effort as well. So it's interesting to see individual militants being caught in that tension. So I try to see how one becomes a transnationalist, for instance. I haven't found that much literature. Recently, there was an excellent biography of Ellen Wilkinson by Matt Perry. So this is outside French circles, but an attempt to describe her in a transnational light, again, to shift the focus from national militancy to looking in a transnational context at her militancy. And the framework that Matt Perry used was, interestingly, globalization literature. Contemporary globalization literature, using Sidney Taro's concept of rooted cosmopolitans. And this is how rooted cosmopolitans are defined by Taro. Quote, "Their relational links to their own societies, to other countries, and to international institutions," quote, is what defined them. They are activists who, quote, "face both inward and outward and combine domestic and transnational activism and advocacy." So, and this is in the context of increasingly intertwined society. So this is interesting. It's one potential use. Of course, it's very problematic to use globalization literature to understand the anarchists because there are quite a few differences. I'll come back to this at the end, but I think one issue is, of course, the role of formal organization and the role of ideology and perception of the state. But it's a temptation and it works, but I'll come back to this. So briefly to conclude on this, so far, if I think we try to look at these international militants, of which there were many, many in the anarchist movement, Graf is a very striking example, but by no means the only one, we can perhaps think of a number of different typologies. The classic one is looking at different repertoires of activism. How were they acting? Was it through their writing, through conference giving, organizing terror plots? This is one possibility. The other approach is to look at the networks. Who were they connected with? Can we describe their networks? Can we describe spheres of influence? Or a third approach, which I find really interesting, is to look at the reception. It's very different to have a militant like Graf, who was influential but very much hidden, and to have, by contrast, somebody like Louise Michel with an absolutely staggering legacy and very much a process of myth-making even when she was alive. So another two very different types of militant and militant profiles and influence there. So Grave's network to move on to this. So Grave's papers, all his publications, so three newspapers, a number of brochures. So here we have two examples of the Publication des Temps Nouveaux. Sorry, it's not very clear. La Morale Anarchiste is published by Les Temps Nouveaux. L'État, son rôle historique is published as well by Les Publications des Temps Nouveaux. But there was also Les Publications de la Révolte in the 1880s, and they were very, very productive presses. He had a huge output there, not only of his own writing, but also, perhaps more importantly, of Kropotkin, who was, of course, the leading influence in anarchist communism at the time. So a large amount of production over a period of 40 years, more or less. So what did these papers and all these publications do? Well, first of all, of course, they disseminated ideas. They were possibly the most influential medium for the spread of anarchist-communist ideas in the period. Grave was closely linked with Kropotkin, who had a lot of influence. He was closely linked with many theorists. He was an influential journalist and theorist himself. So that was the first function of these periodicals. Secondly, they were also very important in building an international movement. In all these issues in the paper, there would be a Mouvement Social section, and in there you would find reports on the Mouvement Social in a great variety of countries. European countries, you would probably, at the peak of the exile period, you would have weekly correspondences from London, written by somebody who was in London, which is quite an achievement for a very, very poor publication. But you would find also correspondences about the movement in Georgia, Armenia, South Africa. Wherever there was anarchism, it featured in the Temps Nouveaux. So this was extremely impressive. Grave was very, very proactive in trying to secure a network of correspondents. He very often struggled to do so. In this case, he would procure articles from the local press of foreign newspapers and get it translated by some of his contacts. And he was lucky to have a few very multilingual contacts to help him. So a very important dimension was really building an international network, and Grave was very consciously doing that. Another important dimension is what I call the paratextual element. So this seems very anecdotal, and I apologize for the very poor quality of the image, but here this is the section Petite Correspondance. If we were to look more closely, it's, well, I'll summarize it for you. In all that section, Petite Correspondance, you have notes, sometimes just an initial, but it gives a location with it. And in this issue, we have at least two correspondents in from New York, one from Paterson, which is a very large anarchist center in the United States, one from Buenos Aires. You have countless contributions from all over France, from London, of course, that's a given. There would always be someone in London, someone in Italy as well, and they would be talking about a great variety of things. Sometimes they would just be talking about buying anarchist literature, reselling it, advertising a meeting for their local anarchist group. They would be trying to make contact, very often cryptic messages with just initials about where people could meet. So this section means that the paper was a key organizational place for the movement. And because it was circulated on this global scale, then it could do so very, very effectively. So again, in technical terms, people tend to describe these papers as nodes or hub in the network because they had a key organizing role as well. In terms of the distribution of the paper, we know we don't have that many figures. This is a more difficult aspect to document, but it will have to be done eventually. But I think in the mid-80s, La Révolte, which was the predecessor of Les Temps Nouveaux, which we see here in the mid-90s, there were about 1,000 subscribers to the papers. And out of these, 700 were based in France, and 300 were based abroad. So that's one third based abroad, which again, at the time, is quite an achievement for such a rudimentary or let's say precarious publication. And the majority of them were in the United States, but also there were very large groups, well, again, in England, Italy, Romania appears to have been the largest subscribing group in Eastern Europe. So quite a strong dissemination, which meant that the paper could fulfill this role in spreading ideas, but also in organizing the movement. So Graf was very aware of the organizational importance of the papers. So he said in his autobiography, and this is in French, "Nous avions des lecteurs et abonnés un peu partout, dans les coins les plus inattendus. Des gouvernements de l'Amérique du Sud et centrale nous faisaient l'échange de leur journal officiel. Il m'a été raconté que Malatesta, lorsqu'il visita la Terre de Feu, aperçut dans la première cabane où il entra un numéro du Révolté." So this is, I find, slightly coy because, as I mentioned earlier, Graf was very, very proactive in building the network, and this is something which he pursued very, very actively. He had, in fact, a very clear conception of what he wanted to achieve with this paper. So in 1919, he wrote to his Swiss friend and fellow journalist Jacques Ross, cite in French again, "Je considère qu'un journal est fait pour faire de la propagande, pour essayer de raccrocher les lecteurs, et non pas pour être lu seulement par un cercle fermé de lecteurs déjà convaincus. Sans vanité, sans vouloir en rien diminuer la valeur du Réveil," which was Jacques Ross's own paper, "je crois que les temps nouveaux tiennent une autre place que lui dans le mouvement anarchiste mondial." Right. So this is what I'd like to document, but it simply is really this project and how Graf tried to develop this project and to what extent it was successful or not. So in terms of Graf's circles, now if we can describe it, I think there were five different groups at work, at least, in each of his publications. First, very close association with Freedom, the longest running, at the time, British anarchist paper, which Graf described as a brother-in-arm publication in London. And I think there were very tight editorial links there, so almost a transnational basis for the publication of this journal. There is a lot of correspondence between Graf and Kropotkin, who was overlooking Les Temps Nouveaux in London, and a lot of exchange of articles. So that's the first level. Second level, of course, regular contributors or staff, so a close network of immediate collaborators. Secondary links, but very important, with individuals who are very well connected themselves and very often were early collectors and antiquarians of the anarchist movement. So typically Max Netlau, whose collection is now the bulk of the anarchist collection at the Amsterdam International Institute of Social History, who was he's been called the earliest historian of anarchism. He was multilingual, he knew a lot of people, and there is a lot of evidence of Graf asking him constantly for contacts, for information about the movement in Prague or in this country. Can you translate this article for me? So networks, contacts with very well-connected people, of the same at the same level. A very important group I haven't mentioned so far, the artistic contributors. And here you have an example. Two examples. This one is by Van Rieselberg. And this one, I am not fully certain. I don't know if there is somebody who's well versed in art who might be able to identify this, but in any case, there was a very strong connection between Graf and artistic circles, and especially neo-impressionist. The newspapers, all of Graf's publication had tight links with artistic avant-garde, were interested in anarchism at the time. So there was a literary supplement to Les Temps Nouveaux. And in this very eclectic publication, sometimes a very prominent writers would be published with or without their agreement, but very often with. So a very long list of names were, or impressionistic at least. So Octave Mirbeau, a key member of the anarchist literary canon, and he was a close friend of Graf, Camille Huysmans, Émile Zola, Les Temps Nouveaux interestingly reproduced extracts from Maurice Barrès, and Barrès was a subscriber to Les Temps Nouveaux as well, so again, interesting connection. Bernard Lazare was, of course, prominently involved at the time of the Dreyfus affair. And in terms of visual art, Lucien Pissarro, Maximilien Luce, Paul Signac, Jacques Ross, Théophile van Rysselberghe, Lucien Steinlein, and Grandjean, Kupka, Vallotton. So people who would later achieve considerable fame were early collaborators of Les Temps Nouveaux. And this was a very important connection as well, because it also, well, among other things, it contributed to profile raising, but also to it made it possible to collect funds through a special edition sometimes. And then the last level, a very large myriad of correspondents, subscribers, contacts, who might have worked once for the paper, sent in something, but who were very important in building its influence. Two aspects I'd like to document as well in this respect is the downfall of the paper, especially what happens when this kind of venture comes to an end, and especially, tragically, quite a lot is known about this period, about Carve's effort to resurrect the paper, to keep the network going. So we see, I think, an interesting side of a militant venture when it comes to an end here. And also the financial life of the publication, which Carve writes a lot, quite a lot about in the paper. And I think this is a facet of anarchism we do not see very often. So I'd like to document this. Before concluding, I'd just like to talk briefly about the broader context of these networks after using all this very specific terminology. My framework is really the same that my colleague Davide Torcato used in his biography of Malatesta. I think a transnational angle sheds a revisionist light on the anarchist movement. In the case of France, I think it can really pull the history of the movement out of a very Franco-centric approach and resurrect a wealth of contacts which has really been ignored. But also, it means revising some of our assumptions about anarchism. So, for instance, it's often taken for granted that French anarchism partly gave birth to the CGT and to syndicalisme révolutionnaire, when in fact, if you look more closely, it's quite obvious that there were very strong international influences behind this. So I think it's a welcome broadening of the angle in this case. Turcato, in his biography of Malatesta, also says that this transnational shift makes it possible to revise understanding of anarchism as a whole and to get out of this, he calls it, advance and retreat pattern of interpretation, saying, oh, the anarchist movement, they were a failed movement, they were very irrational in their organization, they had outbursts and periods of great activity, and then they collapsed again. Whereas if you adopt a transnational angle, you do see a picture of great, or far greater at least, coherence and stability. So in the French case, what is often assumed to be a complete shutdown of activity in the 1890s under the effect of repression is just a displacement of activity to external centers like London, for instance, or the United States. And also, instead of this idea of the anarchists as being poorly organized, what you see, in fact, is a very efficient and resilient mode of organization through this idea of network. And there is quite a shift in there. There have been three main other interpretations of this network. So let's say people use these networks, or this idea of anarchist networks, in three broad interpretations. One of them, which of course has generated a lot of writing, is this idea of anarchist networks as forerunners of today's terrorist networks. Very, very popular. It appeared, in certain circles, but we see the first emergence of this comparison after 9/11 in a MA dissertation, I think, written by somebody who was in Cambridge at the time, who was American. But it's been it's featured in the media after the 7/7 bombings here. There was an article in The Economist, for instance. There has been quite a lot of literature comparing anarchist networks with jihadi networks, which doesn't make any sense. Well, it makes very superficial sense, but it's been explored in depth. So there was a great debate in the American academic journal, Terrorism and Political Violence, where somebody attempted a comparison of anarchist ideology and Islamist fundamentalism to show that they were very similar. This was a professor at UCLA, but then somebody else replied. It went on for a long time. It's not completely finished. The book I showed early on about the Haymarket conspiracy was an attempt to resurrect that. We see a very blunt example of terrorist networks in the anarchist movement. It's true that there were transnational terrorist networks within the anarchist movement, but they were such a minority amidst all the activism and ideological discussion that went on that it's just, it doesn't make much sense. Two other lines of exploration are far more fruitful. One of them is from my colleague Tom Goyens, who works on German anarchists in the United States, who uses spatial turn ideas to examine how networks structure space and work as counter-communities. So the idea of the anarchist networks as counter-communities to oppose the rest of society and to prefigure anarchist ideals. So it's a very interesting idea, and in practice it works really well. It's a different theoretical approach, but the idea, for instance, that anarchists would congregate in beer halls in New York, which is something he writes extensively about, it's quite operational. It works well. And lastly, comparison with what globalization scholars call transnational advocacy networks. And it has been very tempting to describe this phase of intense anarchist activity before the First World War as a prefiguration of what, again, is called counter-hegemonic globalization. So a movement organized on a global scale from below to challenge a capitalist globalization, which was led at the same time. It's a very convincing idea. Again, I was more convinced by it a few years ago than I am now. I think it's very tempting for historians today to try and appropriate the today's auto-globalization movement and say, oh, we are the forerunners of it. This is our movement. We are the ancestors. There is room for debate. There are parallels here, especially if we look at big anarchist campaigns. Their works, so some people are researching this specifically, but it's an interesting vista. And I think in any case, people working on transnational actors in this period can see some relevant parallels there. To conclude, I will start with a quotation of a review of that book on the Russian-Japanese networks, which I showed at the beginning of the presentation. So the reviewer welcomed the book as a very welcome antidote to, I quote, a history lost to a historiographic gaze incapable of seeing non-state cross-border networks and movements, end quote. This depends, of course, of the area which we are discussing. In my case, if you talk about Franco-British networks, this is not true anymore. We know of a great wealth of Franco-British militant networks and informal links going back at least to the period of the French Revolution. But in the French case, if you look beyond Britain, it's true that the transnational links of the French labour movement are really, really poorly known, and this applies to anarchism very much, even though it was such an internationalist movement. So this is one of the things I'm hoping to uncover through Graf. But of course, this leaves us with at least two problems. The first one is the classic reproach addressed to many transnational historians, is of course the peril of Eurocentrism. I'm very aware here that I've spoken about all these ideas and all this material leaving from France to be spread or not across the globe. At a later stage of my research, of course, I will look at the receiving point and examining the reception of this idea, its appropriation, its adaptation. But I do think this is a big point of debate at the moment among historians of anarchism. But I do think it's a bit of a retrospective construct, this debate about Eurocentrism, that at the time, I'm not sure people had this idea of we are sending our movement abroad, we're exporting our ideas. I think it was far more an egalitarian exchange, and people generally wanted to know what was happening in other countries. They were generally interested. There was an exchange of idea. I don't think there was so much hierarchy placed on the direction of the flows. Secondly, and relatedly, what has been called the problem of dots and lines. That is to say, we are working here on flows. We're talking about flows, so many flows. It's great. Can we trace them? Where do they go? It's very important to pay attention. Of course, it's essential to the dots and what happens in these dots. Why are people in South Africa reading Le Temps Nouveau? Why are they interested in it? What do they do with it? Is it something more than superficial? So this is when, the historian of networks needs to rely on their own networks as well to see what was happening in so many different places. We're very lucky that, I am very lucky that so many people study so many local movements, because hopefully this is something we can retrace. But to have a map of reception, the reception of this idea, this is absolutely crucial. And I will finish on this with a citation from Max Netlau, discussed earlier, writing to the British anarchist Tom Keel in 1910. I think he discusses this idea of influence in the anarchist world. And I think it shows great awareness of this idea of just sending out ideas and the hope that they will be received and adopted. And it shows a very subtle understanding. So, cited. I think it is not only useless but illogical to expect to introduce French and American syndicalist methods in England, just as no one would hear of German methods, just as impossible as to introduce French habits and methods and French temper in public life. Great. So I think what you see here is very open discussion of what we call today cultural transfers, and I think what emerges as well is a great anarchist awareness of the subtleties of these things, that you don't export your ideas just like that. So it leads me to think that anarchists of the 19th century, had they been aware of this concept of cultural transfers and networks, I'm fairly sure they would have embraced them.
Hey, thank you very much. And for me, it's really, really illuminating in terms of Graaf himself and the anarchist movement, but also I'm sure you'll agree, lots to think about in terms of transnational history, how we write transnational history, what it means to live a transnational life, and how we think about transnationalism and internationalism. So lots and lots of questions. We have about 35 minutes for questions, so I will open the floor. Shall I start? I'll start. I was thinking, it was something that I had been thinking about while you were speaking, and then you ended on it, and that was the voices of the anarchists themselves and how they talk about themselves and how they describe their activity and their conception of their behaviour. Obviously, they didn't have the term cultural transfer, they didn't describe it as transnationalism, but could you say a little bit more about how the anarchists saw their own activity, and I suppose how they saw the flows working? I mean, are the flows just going in one direction, or did they see it as exchanges, or yes. A little bit more from the anarchists?
Yes, absolutely. There is a great deal of literature on organization, and especially on a national level, and a lot of it is anti-groups. We don't like groups, and groups are bad, they're hierarchical, and they come close. Well, they talk about circles. They talk about loose affinity group. It's from a retrospective historian, but they do really come close to theorizing punctual organization, flexible modes of organization. There is a long history of trying to set up an international as well. So you have this backdrop of failure to set up an international, and every now and then somebody will say, but look, we work really well like we do. You know, and somebody will say, for instance, our papers, they are the real life of the movement. So you do really come close, I think, to what historians are looking at the moment. And I don't think this is really violating their own ideas, really. It's just, I guess, using the tools that we have now to describe what some of them really try to theorize in terms of organization. I think some of them never completely gave up this idea of a formal organization, but there were also a lot of counter voices, so ongoing debate. And in terms of the flows, I think it would depend where. Many groups, publications had no interest in the international movement. But publications, the leading publications in any country, had a very clear internationalist stance, and they were very, very keen to establish links, to gather as much information as possible on foreign movements, really with a view to an international revolution and also to networking.
That's interesting.
Thank you very much. I would like to push back a little bit on your argument against maybe not so much against, but your argument for a more narrative style of network analysis, maybe a little bit against the formal type. One of the strong points there is, of course, that they try to really do something new and show new things. Whereas in your approach, I'm not quite sure what is the real benefit of calling something a network other than calling it a group. I mean, you don't feel comfortable, obviously, with the term group, or don't think it's the way to go, but you didn't really present any arguments to show that it's actually better to call it one thing or the other. So I think there is a big difference, because the formal type of network analysis really, in its best incarnations, is able to show new things about the material, whereas you seem to be looking more to a new way of describing them, just new words.
It's describing them, that's true, and but describing what they do. I think some of the terms used by formal or structural network analysts have a lot of potential. So this egocentric networks, I guess what I was trying to do here with Grav is sort of not watered down, but it's a version of that. So this idea of how you look at it, for instance, this idea of hybridity, a lot of the words which I use, which for me convey a number of things and entail a number of things, are borrowed from structural network analysis, and you certainly couldn't do it with a group. Group implies closure, for instance. There was nothing approaching a group on an international scale. It's true. There is, to some degree, it's a bit of a default term. I have toyed with other terms. Other historians have used it. But to describe the very complex, even if they were small, they were quite complex organization and very productive organization. There is nothing which works like networks. And again, the specific terms borrowed from more technical approaches work very well to describe what these networks can do.
Well, I might be in a minority of one, but you defined network, but you haven't defined anarchist.
Yes.
And what were the dominant ideas that linked all these groups or circles in a network which went through the world?
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Well, that's something I'd be extremely cautious about, because this is what I discuss in the conclusion. There was, it's difficult to define a common ground at this stage, and I wouldn't want to overgeneralize. I guess the one thing I would venture was an adherence in that case to the ideas of Kropotkin and Élisée Reclus, the basic principles of anarchist communism, as opposed to other strands of anarchism. But again, these were localized, these were adapted locally. There is another volume which I haven't featured in the presentation, which is about to be released, and it's about anarchism in Latin America. And there we see anarchism being used in anti-colonial, anti-imperial context, and this is completely different from the French context, of course. So a great deal of adaptation. So one of the questions, well, were they really speaking the same language, or how was ideology adapted? Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. I'd just like to thank you for really a very interesting and inspiring sort of analysis of the anarchist movement, because it is very difficult, and a lot of historians have done things, for example, look at the international anarchist movement in London, but not really analysed how those international links were, but just accepted that there are lots of people from different countries who call themselves anarchists. And what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is just suggest one or two ideas
yes.
that came to me while you were talking. The first one was the role of the individual. And Carl Levy, when he was talking about Gramsci, and Gramsci's ideas, which might be adapted by anarchism, looks at the role of the subversive individual. And that might be something which could be explored in this context of the network. And the individual's relationship to the network. Another point which did occur to me is the role of the counter-networks that are operating internationally, i.e. the international police, because not only did they infiltrate the anarchist network in some instances, as with the French anarchist paper, Intransigent, and also possibly with Louise Michel's school, they actually set up some of what you might call the nodes of the network. So this counter, it was a very extensive network, because if you look in the Parisian police archives, there are dozens and dozens of people reporting back with written reports on a regular basis. And then there were the German, the Russians, the Italians, and had more information about the Italian movement, and British anarchism survives in a lot of these kind of continental archives rather than in British ones. When you're talking about different terms like loose affinity groups, cells, and local circles, Sherry Gemmy has actually written quite an interesting little article about the idea of the milieu and the and that being a kind of focus for anarchist organisation. And it might well actually fit in very well with the idea of network analysis. Something else which I feel possibly could be looked at is the fact that so many of the foreign anarchists in places like London at the time were actually fleeing from repression at home, either in the wake of the Paris Commune, for example, in instance of French anarchists, or again at the time of the Trial of the 30, or in Germany there was a strong repression, and a lot of people came over with Hermann Most, and they were involved with anarchist periodicals as well. So you can see very clearly that that one of the driving forces behind the anarchist diaspora is not just police repression, but social, political repression in the anarchist own countries. In the LSE, there used to be, but I don't know whether it still is there, because I've heard different reports, there was a copy of all the early numbers of Freedom, which have the contributors identified on there. And you might find whether there's any contacts from the French movement actually contributing to articles to Freedom. An artist who contributed to Le Temps Nouveau from England was Walter Crane. So you can see the network working both ways. The problems with resuscitating Le Temps Nouveau was one of the problems that anarchist networks must have experienced generally after the First World War, with the rise of the Communist Party and a different rival set of international networks, and a lot of people effectively defecting to the Bolshevik or Communist international networks. As regards whether we can look at networks, or we have to think of them as just being groups, I think a study of the London anarchist clubs would show very clearly the links between the clubs and the different nationalities and so on, and show that they're definitely networks, not just groups. Sorry if that's a very bitty sort of comment, but it's such a wonderful paper, I wouldn't like to sort of put to pieces at all.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you. Thank you for your suggestions. They're all great. I'll just say a word. You're right on counter networks, and I think it's a great temptation, especially with the anarchist movement, to dispense with the state and the national framework altogether, because anarchists rejected the state. They tried to operate outside the state, but of course it would be a grave mistake, because they were seriously bound by the state and repression, police, and this in turn. The anarchist movement was one of the greatest catalysts for the emergence of national and international police forces across the Western world. So if you ignore this, you ignore a very important aspect of the anarchist movement, but also of the nation state as well. So anarchists may have wanted to dispense with the state, but it's very important to really look at it very closely with the emergence of, well, Interpol famously was derived from organizations meant to counter anarchism at the turn of the century. So very important to bear this in mind, but I'd never thought of it in terms of counter networks, because here I tend to think it's institutions and it's far more formal, but there were also networks.
They recruited from within the anarchist network, so there were networks within networks.
Yes, and also all the
informal. One of the things as well about the international police networks was that if there is any correspondence between the networks at the time of the anarchist terrorism and contemporary terrorist networks, one of the consistent factors is police penetration of those networks and the use of agents provocateurs and informers. And so, you know, that is one consistent aspect about the point of comparison, which is never mentioned. But, you know, it's very noticeable when you look at them carefully.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you for your paper. I learned a lot. It was really, really fascinating. And my questions are coming from a perspective of not total ignorance, but not far. So I was wondering maybe if, first of all, you could define this group of anarchists a little bit more, and, you know, kind of picking up on this idea of not just ideas, but the community. It's so hard to talk about numbers. I imagine the statistics are like extraordinarily difficult. But I was wondering, in the case of anarchists, what estimates, what are we talking about? Is this a really male-dominated space? What social areas or maybe regions are more affected? Just to give a kind of idea of the people involved. And the other question was, Les Temps Nouveaux, I thought, you know, the explanations, the study you've done of this paper really shows these international connections. I was wondering what other mediums were used. I was thinking about international conferences, travel, letters. How do they fit into this picture of Les Temps Nouveaux and the other publications? So outside of publications, what other? Twitter today, but...
Yeah. Well, thank you, too. Yeah. Very, very good question. So anarchism in France, you're right, it's difficult to collect numbers because they tend to be systematically inflated by the police. Mm. I think at the peak of the movement, we're probably looking at around 10,000 people. The peak of the movement is in the early 1890s, but the police would count as an anarchist, an anarchiste convaincu, somebody who would be found with an issue of a paper, for instance, or who would be seen in a meeting. And, of course, there was the thrill of attending those meetings, so probably really inflated numbers. But then there was a core, very, very active militants. In terms of the movement, if we can characterize it, I guess a good place to start is that it tends to be described as another of these sort of radical artisan movements, and in fact, it's a lot more complex than this. In France, as opposed to, say, Italy or Spain, it's an urban movement. It tends to be an urban movement, even if it's small cities, in the traditional revolutionary trade, so shoemaking. Timothy Graff was a shoemaker himself, but it also tapped a little bit into the factory proletariat, a little bit, because they mainly evolved towards Marxist ideas. Very grateful for your question about whether it was male dominated, because I went to a conference on anarchist spaces last year, and for 2 hours no one pronounced the word female, and they were talking about the sociological composition of anarchism. So I'm very happy. Women were there. Women were definitely there, but they tended to be ignored in police archives. So it's more difficult to highlight their presence beyond famous cases like Louise Michel or a handful of other women. They were often described as the wives of so-and-so, but they played a role, and especially in the light of these networks, they really played a role of carriers, sometimes of news. They took a lot of risks, smuggling documents, this kind of things, but their presence would usually not be counted if they attended anarchist meetings, so it's more difficult, and I think there are quite a lot of people working on this at the moment, trying to resurrect this female presence. In terms of regional presence, very Paris-based, Lyon was initially the largest centre of anarchist presence in France. And so that's anarchism really in the 1880s, early 1890s, and after this it spreads in a variety of directions, very many focused on alternative lifestyles, community buildings, communes, and all sorts of direct individualist anarchism, which ends up with La Bande à Bonneau and radical burglary, terrorism, etc., but also labour organising in the CGT through revolutionary syndicalism. As for the other medium, very good question. I didn't go into this because I didn't have the time, but initially there were conferences. There was one in London, 1881. It's the first one in that cycle, the London Revolutionary Social Revolutionary Conference, where terrorist ideas sort of prevailed. And there were regular conferences, maybe every 5 years in this period. But these networks, they're really an alternative, and they theorized as such to the failure of, first of all, remaining in the Second International. The anarchists are evicted from the Second International in 1896, and in London, actually. So that's what they would have wanted. Well, it's hard to say, but they tried to set up their own formal organization. There were conferences, and it didn't work. But what happened is, for instance, during that London conference, when they were evicted from the Second International, there were a lot of fringe meetings, and that's exactly the kind of things I look at. See who met who. They had all sorts of meetings, and clearly people got to talk. So, for instance, the French anarchists, many of them met Tom Mann, who later became who worked very closely with some French militants. So, a tiny network formed with quite an influential British militant, and it really lasted until the First World War. So conferences, very much so. Travel a lot. The question is, how do we document it? But exile, well, daily contact through exile in anarchist clubs, so the Autonomy Club in London, but also in the United States. So, yes, letters, if we can have the correspondences, yes, of course, exactly. This is exactly the kind of things I look at resurrect the networks outside these sources, because you can contextualize them. When you have a correspondence, you understand what's happening behind the finished product, that is the newspaper. Thank you.
Just about that, what about language? So your base is French one, so were they speaking English, or were the English people learning French and having translation?
Yes, thank you. They tried to learn Esperanto in the 1880s. There was a very strong movement towards Esperanto. There's a marginal movement to learn Esperanto throughout the period. But what they did, and again, the mediator, the figure of the intermediary is very important for this. Translators were important intermediaries. Only a handful of them could speak multiple languages. People who were fluent linguists were very much in demand, but very often you'd have people like Netlau who spoke fluently five languages, or you have one Charles Malatour, who is a very interesting secondary figure, but spoke Italian, Spanish, French, English. And I also try to find traces of this. Sometimes it's documented. When Louise Michel started learning English, it was announced in the anarchist press as a great internationalist gesture. Otherwise, she was translated into English by Louise Bevington, who was a British militant. So you do have translators would be the most common way of circulating literature. And it was a very, very big problem, of course.
Can I ask you two questions?
Yeah.
One, to what extent were articles in anarchist newspapers in London or New York or Paris transposed into other newspapers? Because earlier in the century, this tended to happen quite a lot. And I wonder if you... I don't mean an anarchist newspaper, because there weren't any, but, you know, in things like the Distress and so on, that you get an actual translation. Whether that happened, and that's my question. And the other, you've touched on this, the relationship between anarchists and the international workers' movement, and what the quarrel between them, what impact that had on anarchism.
Thank you very much. Well, the first question, yes, absolutely. There were many what we call now cut and paste and translate. So, for instance, between Freedom and L'État Nouveau, but also a mainstream foreign newspapers. We have evidence of articles being borrowed, translated. So, you're right, it was a very, very common practice at the time. So we call it cut and paste. I think it was hectorized at the time. I found the term for it recently, but it was...
Sorry, what was that?
Hectorized, I think. I'm not fully sure. I found the technical term for it. I think now people tend to call it cut and paste, but there is a technical term for this practice of borrowing articles, maybe translating them. And you'd find not so much from the mainstream press, like L'Illustration, but I think internationally this is definitely something you would find more, because I guess within the French landscape, they would know that this was not an anarchist paper, and therefore, ideologically, there would be differences, or this would be an unreliable account. But, of course, this is something that tends to be lost in translation. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you would find mainstream newspapers. Well, I think I've come across quite a few cases of British newspapers like The Times being reproduced in French anarchist periodicals, for instance. And... So, yes, very common practice. And in the Supplément Littéraire, of course, Krav tended to reproduce quite a lot of articles. And in a few occasions, he had to pay very hefty copyright duties after the publication for failing to ask for permission before. So, famously, Maupassant and Zola came asking for significant sums. And in terms of the relationship with the international, it was... 1896 is a watershed for them. This is when they decide on a strategic reorientation, which had been underway for some time, and it prompts really the definite turn in the French context towards trade unionism, completely detached from the state. But again, it's very dependent on different contexts. I think in the British context, which is very different, the response is less dramatic because, in some respect, the stakes are lower. But in France, 1896 was really encouraged many anarchists who were interested in trade union militancy to join the CGT towards and to embrace an apolitical message of trade union militancy.
And encourage them towards syndicalism.
Yes. Yes. And it's really, there are many encouragements to do this in the press, in some brochures. It's seen as the way forward after this major setback.
Does it mean also that there's less contact with anarchists abroad? Does that
Well, that period is a period when exile, for instance, many of the French who are in London go back to France. It's a period of renationalization. So there is less contact, but it's also because the movement is less agitated. There is greater national integration. The CGT will work as a powerful tool of national integration, but it takes on different form. It is reborn at the turn of the century. With the Dreyfus Affair, you see some international activity, at the same time also protests against clerical repression in Spain, huge catalyst for international activity. And then towards the war, it just reappears, but in different guises and different forms. Thank you.
Sorry to ask a second question, sort of thing, but I'd like to come back to this question about the role of women in international networks and what you said about contemporary historians at a conference and also about the under-recording of women in anarchist networks. And I wonder if it's because both historians and contemporary historians and also the police themselves didn't recognise what were some anarchist methods of organisation, such as the role of teaching and education, free schools and so on, within a framework of anarchist propaganda. And for most people, the fact that somebody was a teacher wasn't seen as being particularly subversive, even though they were busy putting forward a secular education and all sorts of ideas about social organisation, the importance of popular folk cultures and things like this, which wasn't being proposed in mainstream education. It just wasn't seen as being a political role, except by the anarchists themselves.
Yes, that's very true. I hadn't thought of that, but that's very, very true. And I wonder if it's true of contemporary historians as well. But there was that, and I think the other tendency, which is far better researched, is this idea of women, politicized women, being portrayed as, well, lunatics. And this is the terminology which would have been used at the time, the virago, the violent woman, especially Louise Michel was the template for this, the new Charlotte Corday, etc. So there was a way of depoliticizing their action and casting them aside. And this is in, especially within anarchism, definitely. So I think you're right as well, not perceiving the sort of more educational forms of militancy. And I guess the third direction is also everything to do with sexual threat. I guess, for instance, all the anarchist militancy towards neo-Malthusianism, all these sort of lifestyle, free marriage, this kind of things, which were serious anarchist themes at the time, were derided or cast aside because they were just perceived as sexual perversion.
Yes, and the role of anarchist women in promoting contraception. Things like that, not seen specifically as being political.
Exactly.
It's also, if I can say something, the patriarchal attitude amongst the authorities that that women pose no threat to men. I mean, I don't mean socially, but I mean, in terms of politics with a capital P. So you just wouldn't, if you went into a room and it was half men and half women, police would be really only concerned with the guys there, because that's
yes, and they would be described usually as with the name of their spouse or their partners, la femme. And you would see them in archives, and very often what you find in archives from the police or spy reports is a report on their love life as opposed to their militancy. But these were fillers during periods of lesser activity. They would just report on the
Pierre Latouche writes about, when he writes about the one of the anarchist clubs, the Windmill Club, where Louise Michel's school starts, he he specifically mentions the large numbers of women that are attending the club and the fashionable dress that they wear, that, you know, so the sort of trilby hats and things like that, fashionable sort of trousers, and you know, so obviously there were quite a lot of women at the clubs and just invisible to anybody using patriarchal spectacles.
So we've taken a tour from kind of methodological approaches, big ideas, down to the detail of the sources and what's going on. And just before we thank Constance again, Pam, did you have something that you wanted to say do?
I come back to Ian, not Renee, as he was currently here. What I'd like to do is just to say a little bit about Manchester University Press and the series in Modern French History, which I would like to pass around our latest leaflet and our latest book, because another volume has come out, which is not on an anarchist, I'm afraid, on two bankers, 19th century bankers. And if that could be, you could have a look at it. And we've got another volume coming out in June on cartoons in the first half of the 19th century. It's quite an active series, and I think I'll have another one very soon.
It's
a lovely series, and I only want to mention it to encourage other people to follow Andrew's example and John Smith's to send to me or to our editor at Manchester University Press suggestions for books that they'd like to publish.
So think of the French History series at Manchester University Press when you're thinking about your next publications. One final notice, which is our next seminar is in 2 weeks' time. It will be a roundtable on Astrid Svensson's new book, which is The Rise of Heritage, Preserving the Past in France, Germany and England. And there'll be comments from Richard Evans and Peter Mandler. So that's 2 weeks' time in this room. Notices out of the way, publication plans in place for everyone in the room. All that remains now is to thank Constance, and any other questions, I hope you won't mind me saying, you'll take them over a drink in the Birkbeck Bar.
Okay.
Thank you very much.